7:30 p.m. at the Jack London Review, 529 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
From the radio station that brought you the Fall Drive thank you spot comes an on-air acknowledgement so controversial it will blow your mind.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's holiday membership drive. Your support makes KBOO possible. Thank you.
Oh, the humanity!
Our end-of-year fundraising campaign is still going on. Go to kboo.fm/give to donate right now.
Radio will never be the same again.
Support KBOO, where music makes the movement.
Absolutely the most interesting and exciting organizing happening. So I'm speaking to Amina.
Hey.
And Luis.
Hello.
From the Burgerville Workers Union and from the Industrial Workers of the World, the legendary. So thank y'all for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so for just a little bit of background for people that are listening, Burgerville, everyone's favorite local organic liberal,
it's not organic,
just all of the buzzwords that you could ever need to feel good about your consumption. Burgerville will serve to you on a bun, and they insist that their business model would not be sustainable if it was not for the poverty wages that they dole out to their workers. And if you are anything like me, you know that that is unacceptable and a lie. So when the workers got organized and began to fight together against the boss, people all over Portland were electrified. And not long after that, so was other people around the country that are fighting in low-wage sectors, particularly in low-wage food service. And the idea of what's possible is exploding. So I feel like I should say, on behalf of many listeners who care about workers' rights and economic justice, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So can y'all start off by giving us a little bit of history about your organizing, please?
Wanna go for it?
Sure. Well, for those who don't know, and maybe there's some folks outside of Oregon listening, Burgerville is a local fast food burger joint. It's been around for a while. It's sort of centered around the Portland area. It's pretty good size, actually. People don't realize there's 42 stores, there's 1,200 workers. It's all pretty well clustered in, but there's a lot of them. And yeah, so I've been working at Burgerville for a little over 4 years now. Mostly at the Portland Airport location, and I've been a part of the Burgerville Workers Union, and we've been public for almost 3 years now. It'll be 3 years in April, and we are fighting for some of the things that everybody's fighting for. We're fighting for a raise. We're fighting for better health care. We're fighting for fair scheduling, and we're fighting also, for the right to have an organization. It's important for us to have. We feel it's important for workers in the workplaces to have organizations to just express themselves, whether that's about their working conditions or about their political beliefs, and to support each other and to support building community and building a movement to change the world. So we've been public for over 2 years now, fighting. We had a historic NLRB election victories, a couple of them. Amina, do you want to run those down a little bit?
Sure.
Before you do, can you say what the NLRB is?
Right on. The NLRB is the National Labor Relations Board. I think one of the funny things about labor organizing is that when you get into some of the specifics, it is this, you know, Byzantine, Kafkaesque monster of acronyms and government agencies that really, it's easy to lose the core of this, which is workers taking action against oppression. Mm. So we'll use some acronyms. We're happy to explain them, but they're all just sort of fodder on top of this, the core part of what's going on. Mm-hmm. So the National Labor Relations Board is a federal government agency that administers the laws around union organizing and administers the laws that allow us to force Burgerville to sit down and negotiate with us.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what else we've been up to just last week, I think, maybe it's 2 weeks ago, I'm losing track of time, the union had its third victorious NLRB election at the Hall.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks for coming out and supporting the workers.
Every time. I love y'all.
And so that's the third store that has won, filed for an NLRB election and won. And so we'll be joining the two other stores, 92nd and Powell and Gladstone, in bargaining a contract with the company. And so we're excited. This, I think, continuously shows the company that the union is able to win, file and win elections, and use that as a tool to get the company to negotiate with us about the demands we've had since day one, right? So the union has been around since April 2016, and we've been demanding the same things since April 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And I think these elections are one tool that workers are using to get the company to negotiate and recognize a union and make real changes at the workplace.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the significance of you being the first?
Mm. So there's a little bit of a myth that we need to bust, which is, well, it's I don't think it's anyone's fault. We aren't the first fast food union in the U.S. There was actually, I think it was a burger joint out in Detroit.
Burger King?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I should know my own history. That one was federally recognized and won a contract. I think they lived out their first contract back in the 80s. But then disbanded quickly after that. So we're not the first.
But you are the only.
We're the only.
For now.
Currently. For now.
For
hello.
Now.
Let's hope for now.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a goal.
So many people, myself included, were electrified by the fight for 15.
Mm.
And in New York City, in Queens, that's where some of the first strikes happened. Mm-hmm. And many people thought that it was just an impossible. A lot of organized labor had decided mm-hmm. that was not a worthwhile place to put their resources into. And many people resigned themselves mm-hmm. to the idea that fast food work would be work that would keep you in poverty and
right.
hopefully you could get something else. And but either way, you definitely were going to endure your poverty.
Mm.
And I think the Fight for 15 helped to blow that idea out of the water.
Mm.
And then the victory of your union actually showed what is possible. And you're not even finished.
Right.
So if you can push back against some of the people who would have everyone believe that fast food work deserves to be work that pays poverty wages, mm-hmm. like bang back at them.
Yeah.
What do you have to say?
I think that the core of that belief that I think the Fight for 15 campaign really did a lot of work to shatter, and I think we're doing our part, is the core belief that fast food workers don't deserve that.
Mm.
Not that there's something about, there's this myth that gets talked about, like there's something about fast food work, it's unskilled, it's, you know, dirty somehow, that mm-hmm. deserves lower pay. There's this myth that it's about the work, but really what I think the ideology behind this is there's something about fast food workers
mm.
that, and one of the things I like to say is that the people think that fast food workers are either children or failures, right? Mm. Either they are not building lives in a meaningful way because they're 16, quote unquote,
mm-hmm.
or because they are somehow not 16 and therefore have failed
mm-hmm.
and deserve their lot. You know, and those, especially when you looked at the photographs and the videos and the worker testimonies coming out of the Fight for 15, it was clear how racialized and how that fell right along gender, how that fell right along the sort of deeper inroads of class in our society. That it's insidious to think that there are a section of our society that deserves to struggle, that deserves to be disrespected. And I think that people who say that fast food work doesn't need a union actually are saying that fast food workers don't need a union. Mm-hmm. And as a fast food worker, I'll tell you that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And as someone who loves dearly all of his coworkers, I'll tell you that's ridiculous. There's the most powerful, intelligent, driven people that I know that are working in fast food. And I don't know why they shouldn't have an opportunity to build a great life on that.
Yeah. Thank you. I am trying to. One of the reasons that I wanted to start this show is because I know that a lot of what you and I, Amina and Luis, know to be true are actually ideas that are not widely popular or even understood, let alone empathized with. And I want to help shatter some of these ideas. And the reason that I'm so proud to have even stood on picket lines with y'all and to have been at the original event that we did at the Clinton Street Theater and then marched to the one on what street was that?
26 and Powell.
26 and Powell, right? Like I will always be proud of that as y'all continue to organize every Burkeville that there is and win all of your contract demands, like, and get written into history as people that changed the labor movement. It, you already have. And I'm so happy that I could even say that I had any small part in that because... Y'all deserve your places in history for all of your hard work. So speaking on that, can you talk about some of your current work now that's happening?
Yeah, I think so much of organizing, I think what's really exciting about Burkeville organizing is that it's deep and movement building and relational. So it's fun to talk about like some of the exciting hot button issues like, you know, throwing on some successful pickets or winning elections. I think those things are often more legible to folks who are watching what's going on with the union. But I think for me, like, the most exciting work that's happening is the relationship building happening in the shops. So workers building relationships with their coworkers, getting to know each other, coming together on issues that ring true for their coworkers and making plans for themselves of how to win victories. That's the kind of slower, deeper work that maybe isn't as flashy or easy to see from the outside. So that's the constant. That's a constant organizing that Burkeville workers are up to. Meanwhile, we're also definitely still negotiating the first contract. We haven't come to any final agreement around the contract with the company. We're still organizing the boycott. The boycott is still on. So
boycott Burkeville.
Continue boycotting the company until they sign a fair contract with their workers.
Don't patronize unless they unionize.
That's right. I think building relationships with the community, other unions, learning from the rest of the labor movement, I think all of that work continues to happen.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that going off of that, what you're getting at, Amina, is this really, really beautiful part about labor organizing and like, which is like a subsection of like institution building, you know, which is that what victory means is complicated, right? Because, you know, when we win our demands, when we win a $5 raise, when we win, you know, an anti-verify, when we win, you know, better healthcare for workers, when we win those things, we're still going to need to exist, right? We're still going to need to be an organization of Burkeville workers, whether that's to defend those gains, whether it gets new gains, or to just be to continue that relational work of, you know, lighting people up and seeing the world as a bigger place that they can change. So I think that that's an exciting thing for me, sort of that the end goal, there's never quite an end goal, right? Sure. That seems a little scary, but it's actually some of those exciting parts of doing union organizing. But on the ground level, I mean, we're still building in our shops. We just won this election at Hawthorne. It's very exciting, and we're still at the bargaining table. And I think, you know, I'm not too proud to say that we are making some progress. And I give props to Burgerville for the progress that we have made, tentatively agreeing on some parts of the contract that I think are good, and I think workers are going to be excited about.
Mm. What is an anti-verify?
An end to e-verify. For those who don't know, e-verify is a program run by the federal government that checks your social security number that you give to your employer against the database. And the idea is to essentially weed out undocumented workers from the workforce. That's the core of what E-Verify is meant to do. Burgerville does not specifically use the program called E-Verify, but they use one very similar that does a similar thing. Mm. And so what we want is Burgerville to be a sanctuary employer that is
fabulous.
That is leading the way to create a society that is open, that is welcoming, that is safe, that people can work at Burgerville and feel like their families are secure and that their contribution to Portland is respected.
Sure.
And that's a core of what we're looking for. I mean, and it's another part of that is really trying to be a union of this moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not just looking at all every issue that's always at every workplace. We're trying to figure out, well, what does it mean to be a union right now in 2018 in the United States? And what it means to be standing up for workers' rights in the United States today is to stand up for this, against this xenophobia.
Absolutely.
Against this terror about openness.
Sure.
Right? And the violence that's being done against migrant people right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the labor movement is at its best. All worker organization is at its best when it's internationalist in its scope and pushes back against an idea that immigrants pose any kind of danger to workers that are born here. So what? So what? So if you would have it, can we talk a little bit more about the boycott and the community reaction and response and participation in it?
Yeah, so I think we launched our boycott maybe... It's been almost a year ago. So based off of how the company was responding, really heavily union busting shops and workers who were setting up and coming forward with their demands, taking actions at their stores, they were being met with the company firing workers, retaliating against workers, doing everything that they could do to really stop the union. And so at that point, workers decided, like, in order to win, we also need the community to participate in this, right?
Yes.
Burgerville as a business depends on its reputation, right? They want to be fresh, local, sustainable, and that's supposed to mean something for the consumers. And so there is something that consumers and the community can, something that they can do to support the workers' fight. And so the workers called for a boycott until... a fair contract was signed by the union and the employer. So I think it's been really great. I think we, it's hard to know, like, financially what this means, but the company definitely pays attention to that.
Sure.
And, I think that's one of our supporters' biggest participation is to continue to boycott the company until that contract is signed.
Yeah. Shout out to AJ Mendoza.
Yes.
Also in the IWW, and my comrade at Jobs with Justice, who holds down all of the beautiful light brigades every time you're riding on the freeway and you see the light boards that say Boycott Burgerville. That's AJ and also Justin at Jobs with Justice who take up a lot of the solidarity.
But big love to AJ out there. I hope it was seen.
Yeah, big love to Jay with Jay, like one of our day one supporters, right? Organizations like Jay with Jay who've consistently showed up at pickets, raised money or given resources to support the workers organizing. Mm-hmm. You know?
Can you talk about the media response to some of your organizing And to the boycott clause specifically, please.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't think it's been... I feel like boycotts are pretty easy for people to, like, understand, like, why workers are calling for a boycott, right? Like, something unfair is happening, and until that's corrected, like, don't patronize this business. So I think... I've been surprised. I don't think we've had very much, like, negative blowback around the boycott. I think our biggest goal is to continue spreading the awareness around it, right? Like, for folks to know that the boycott is called and still in effect, right? Like, we get messages every day, like, is this, are you guys still boycotting? Mm-hmm. And we're like, yep, like, until the contract is signed. So it feels more a challenge of just making sure that folks know and the word gets out than, you know, the public being unwilling to, you know, understand what the boycott is about. Sure.
Okay. Well, what I was getting at was that there is tremendous respect for it, where a lot of boycotts have a hard time really catching fire because the organization is not there. So to call for a boycott and then to not take up a serious organizing drive around it is almost for naught,
right?
Because we would end up boycotting everything, right? But there's no ethical consumption under capitalism.
That's
right. You need an organizing drive to be able to keep it alive and to keep people energized around it. So that's what I was getting at.
Right, and I think there was, you know, and continues to be a lot of work done, especially with organizational partners like JOHJ, with other labor unions in town, with community organizations that have agreed that they're in them and their members or their constituents are not going to patronize Burgerville. That's what gives the boycott its power, right? Is when groups of people come together and they say that they're not going to patronize. And I think that came after a lot of work building relationships and getting folks on board to make the boycott actually have some teeth and some be really powerful.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I mean, you just mentioned this question of organization and organizing, and I think that's a point I wanted to hammer home, you know, to all the organizers and activists and revolutionaries out there listening. One of the things that I think that we're trying to do, and I hope people can pick up, is sort of take on this task of organization building. You know, take on this task of building something that's going to stick around for a long time and can be the source of many fights, you know? I think that the boycott, it's a great example, right? Like, boycotts is a tactic, right? And a lot of people call boycotts on stuff and whatever. But what we need to do to be able to build a movement and what we need to do to change the world is to build organizations that can act in a sustained and intentional way. That are going to become the pillars of the bigger movement steps that we're going to be taking down the road, you know? So, you know, lots of people, much love to everyone out there, like, you know, calling boycotts or, like, trying to take action where they can, you know, but, like, build a legacy, you know? Like, that's what we got to be all doing. Like, we're at an early stage of the big stuff we got to do, so let's lay some groundwork.
So one of those organizations, no doubt, is the Industrial Workers of the World. So the Burgerville Workers Union is a local, would you call it, of the IWW or part of?
Part of, yeah.
Okay. Well, can you talk about that relationship? And we don't have 24 hours, but can you talk to people about the IWW, please?
Absolutely. So the Burgerville Workers Union is a part of the IWW. There's a sort of, you know, if you wanted to off mic over a beer, we can talk about the formal whatever about it. But, you know, we're the IWW is, you know, we're an IWW campaign. The IWW is, the IWW is into jazz. It should be. I'm not sure it is. So the IWW is an organization that's been around since 1905. It was back in the teens and 20s, it was a really, really important radical organization for workers, a lot of immigrant workers, you know, we think of white workers today, but, you know, back in 1905, Swedish workers, Italian workers, and Irish workers were not yet white. They were just immigrants who were here to causing trouble, you know, and bringing their radical ideas from
the instability
from
of the idea of whiteness on next week's show. No,
yeah, well, you should. Hopefully. So anyway, the IWW was born in that context. And it, you know, a lot of the history books talk about it going away. You know, a lot of the sort of common sense history of it is that it sort of stopped existing. But it actually never did. Went through some dips and turns and got really small at certain points. But over the last 30 years, it's been slowly being revived by a network of people all around the country and actually around the world. There's a big branch in the UK. Right now, the IWW is organized around the North American continent, so there's lots of members in Canada, and we're in constant relationship with them. Montreal, big out to the Montreal branch of the IWW. Here in Portland, it's been around since 1997, so we're over 20 years now. And what I love about the IWW is that, for one thing, it's really flexible. You know, we're always up to try different kinds of organizing. In fact, sort of this model that we've ended up using, the Burgerville campaign with elections going for contracts, is actually not, you know, universal in the IWW. There's an organizing project called the Stardust Family United in Ellen Stardust Diner in New York City, which is a diner that has seating servers mostly for tourists as customers. They have a union. They've had a union for basically as long as we have. We went public right around the same time. It was really super awesome. They are not going to file an election. They are not going to go for a contract. They just have their organization on the shop floor, and they take action and win stuff. And they've won a lot of stuff. They've won, you know, safety conditions. They've won... I think they've won a lot of ULPs that people got fired and they all got their jobs back. And
what is a ULP?
Oh, sorry, man. Once, as I said, you get stuck in these this little alphabet soup. Unfair labor practice is a ULP is an unfair labor practice, which is a claim that someone has violated the National Labor Relations Act, mm-hmm. which is federal labor law. For all those workers out there, it's a funny thing to call it an unfair labor practice, because there's a lot of unfair labor practices out there. And there's a lot of things that you have experienced that you call unfair that are unfair. But unfortunately, they are not unfair labor practices, quote unquote. It's just about union stuff. But when the law can't help you, you should take direct action, just to throw you out there. So the IWW. The Burgerville Workers Union, we want to build the Wobblies as a fighting institution for low-wage workers in this town. I mean, that's our goal. That's our vision. That's what we have been. I mean, it's not like this is the first organizing campaign the Wobblies have done here in Portland. We have contracts at Janus Youth Programs. We have we've had organizing in lots of restaurants and done strikes and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So, why do you call yourselves the Wobblies?
That, oh man, we're getting into history hour. I think there's probably some people
you said it.
In the KBU.
No, I cannot let anyone on this show use jargon without, yeah.
Respect.
You know, there's actually lots of competing histories of why it is. It's sort of like a little bit lost to time where that nickname came from. But it just kind of functions as a cutesy nickname for this organization that tries to fight real hard and beat up bosses real hard. But we like to joke around a little bit. We like to be like to be cute. We like to call ourselves Wobblies.
Okay. Well, what my education said that it's like imagining a pyramid, and you're on the bottom, and if you make it unstable at the bottom, the top will fall, so you wobble.
I love
it.
We're going to do it. We'll take it.
Yeah.
Okay. it works. It's true. You know, like, wobble at the bottom, the whole thing will fall. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Please make it fall.
Please bring it
down. Yeah. Try it.
Okay. So is there anything else happening now that you want people to know about?
I mean, we talked a little bit about the boycott, keeping an eye out for... I think something exciting that the union always does is calling for community support on action. So we just had workers over at the Hawthorne store just had a celebration picket last week. So celebrating their...
In the rain.
Oh. Our first rainy picket of the season. It's surprising that we've made it this far. we did really good, I think, in our rain ponchos. So celebrating the victory over at Hawthorne and kind of applying more pressure on the company to respond to economic proposals specifically at the bargaining table. Mm-hmm. So I think we always tell folks to keep an eye out for upcoming actions. A lot of the strength, I think, of this union is worker militancy, like folks taking direct action on the shop floor and asking for community support at pickets or slowdowns or whatever it is to remind workers that they have the power that they need to save themselves. I think something inspiring about Wobbly organizing, about Burgerville organizing, is I keep hearing the refrain that, like, no one is coming to save us, right? And I think that's something that this union truly believes, that workers in themselves have the power to change their lives fundamentally.
So then looking toward the future, mm-hmm. what might your supporters expect to see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, apt question today on the solstice coming up on the New Year's.
Yeah, let's set an intention under the moon.
For 2019.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd love to see the company sign a fair contract in 2019, right? And as always, for more workers to be joining the union, more worker organizing happening, and to keep growing and building that organization that Luis is talking about. Luis, do you have any New Year's goals for the union?
I want to see us to be in a place where we're going to be around for 20 years.
Mm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
like I think that it's I have no reason to be cagey about the fact that
yeah.
we like launched on hope and gumdrops, you know, like and adrenaline. And now it's been 3 years, right? Like, and now we're trying to sign a contract. Like, I think that we, you know, we're not a normal union, you know,
like talk about that.
Right. Mm-hmm. We're way smaller than most unions. Right.
Yeah.
I think, other union organizing drives have, you know, paid staffers who are like mm-hmm. not running things, but sort of are really crucial
sometimes
to
they
have,
do.
Sometimes they run
That's
things.
True.
Okay.
And they're connected to these sort of these big internationals that have many contracts that have a lot of pools of resources and money to float around. And we just, mm-hmm. we don't have that, you know? And we've done a lot of really great fundraising and people have shown us a lot of love to mm-hmm. give us the resources that we do have, you know? But I think that we're never going to be, you know, we're not anytime soon going to be in that sort of scale of stuff. And I think that's actually exciting to me, mm-hmm. you know, because the long history of the labor movement, you know, we're talking about the teens and 20s and whatever. And that at that moment in the labor movement, they didn't have resources either, you mm-hmm. know? And today when you go and you talk to, when you think about union organizing in the Philippines or in El Salvador or, you know, like the Congo, you know, unions across the world are not these giant pools of money.
Yeah.
They're workers standing together, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's, if we're gonna revive the labor movement, that's how we've gotta do it.
Yeah.
We've gotta look more like those unions. We've gotta look more like the past, where we've been, which is real worker-driven, sort of scrappy, you know, fighting because we love to fight mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm really excited to see what we can do if we set ourselves that long horizon, mm-hmm. you know, but still try to keep that spirit,
mm.
you know, still try to keep that spirit of little rough around the edges, and little driven by the passion of the people in the organization. So,
can we talk about the swag, the buttons?
Mm. What's going on with the buttons?
Well, I mean, okay. Well, firstly, so that I'm not speaking into the oblivion here. Like what, or the abyss, sorry. Can you talk about the history of wearing buttons at Burgerville and then the ones that y'all chose and how it was controversial, please?
Yeah, so you're going to have to help me with, lost track of the timeline, but so workers have been wearing union buttons since day one. Different types of union buttons, which are, you know, concerted activity. So that's kind of jargon for when you take action as a group, as a union, is protected under federal labor law. And so a lot of unions do wear buttons at work. And so Burrillo workers have been doing that in different ways over the last couple of years. I think you're referring to
the political messages.
The political messages earlier this year, yeah. So so I think it was a couple months ago at the end of the summer, workers over at the Montevilla Burrillo were wearing buttons, and workers from other shops too were wearing buttons, Black Lives Matter buttons, No More Deportation buttons, Abolish ICE buttons, you know, anti-fascist unionism buttons. So quote unquote political messaging. I want to push back on political messaging because I think that's what the company called it, when all messaging is political, right?
Sorry.
Everything unions do is political. Everything we do is political because we're enmeshed in each other and in power dynamics. So folks are wearing this specific type of category of political buttons began to experience retaliation, the company changing policy. The company wanted to take away these buttons and say that these particular types of buttons were not allowed to, folks were not allowed to wear at work. So a whole bunch of shenanigans ensued. You know, I think if I remember correctly, maybe 10 workers walked off the job in unison in protest around the right to wear these buttons and shut down their shop. They took, you know, direct action, defended their rights to wear, to take a stand against racism, xenophobia, fascism in the workplace, in our world, and they. And it was powerful. They shut down the shop, and within like 24 hours, the company kind of backtracked, and they're like, "Oh, you can wear these buttons." And so since then, it's been a little complicated because also at bargaining, this was related to kind of what we've been bargaining at the bargaining table at a couple of shops. So I don't want to get too bogged down in that story.
Okay.
But the punchline is that this is an instance of Burgerville standing with. Standing with racism, standing with, you know, the racist currents in our society, because, you know, they got blowback. They got grumpy old guests who thought that, you know, their burger grill cook wearing an abolished ICE button was offensive to them, you know, and or was inappropriate or got them riled up. And the core of that riled is racism.
Thank you. The core
of that person's, you know, feelings about it is their desire for, you know, to do violence to migrant populations.
Mm-hmm.
And Burgerville had a choice, right? Burgerville had a choice for. Standing with their workers, standing with their employees who were voicing their beliefs and voicing a deep belief in the justice and the freedom for everybody, but they chose to stand with a handful. They chose to stand with racist customers.
Why?
Why do they choose to do that?
Yeah. Why?
I think I have an interesting point about this. Burgerville sits in this really complicated crossroads. Burgerville has this brand, right? This brand that is very progressive, right? But their customer base is most of Oregon, right? They have a couple stores in central Portland, but a lot of their stores are they're actually Vancouver-based, you know? Their stores are in Battleground. Their stores are in you know, Fisher's Landing. They're in Monmouth, you know?
And what about those places?
Those places have a much more complicated history with settler colonialism than, well, they have everywhere. I'm going to backtrack on that phrasing. The way that settler colonialism has played out in those places in 2018 means that open, virulent, racist ideas are very are acceptable and are sort of gaining some traction. One of the things that I'm excited about the Burgerville Workers Union, the workers in those stores. My coworkers are from these areas. You know, I'm not saying these are some backwaters, right? Like, there's a struggle for the periphery right? The periphery of Portland.
Yes, there is.
For the soul of that. And my coworkers, the soul of my coworkers is the desire for freedom, the desire for everyone to live a happy life. That's what my coworkers want. But the social forces, the history of the social forces in that area are fueling a reaction and are fueling racism and are fueling a tendency towards fascist ideas. Mm-hmm. And we, the Burgerville Workers Union, we want to be a force against that. Mm-hmm. So it's important for us, for workers to be standing up and making their voice heard around that kind of stuff. And the company, mm-hmm. the company is looking at the bottom line.
Yes.
The company is looking at who their customers are. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, well, you know, the common sense, the sort of prevailing wind in our market is saying that these things are edgy. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to ruffle any feathers, mm-hmm. you know, but those feathers have to get ruffled. Mm-hmm. Those feathers have to get ruffled because that's there is no neutral ground, right? There is no polite agree to disagree on these issues, you know? It's our historical obligation mm-hmm. to stand on the right side of this important moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Burgerville chose a side.
I should say that there are a lot of people of color who feel alienated in their workspaces, mm-hmm. Not necessarily because of the attacks from the boss, which mm-hmm. are constant and normal.
That's a given.
right. But the silence of their coworkers. Mm-hmm. Please talk about what it's like to be in a workplace where your coworkers are so clearly and definitively practicing anti-racism in a collective way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Louise can speak to that. So I for folks listening in, I don't actually work at Burgerville, so I've been doing the way our union has been functioning for a while is we have workers who work with the union and then folks from the community doing solidarity kind of support work. And so
who are workers too, just don't work at Burgerville.
Right. We're workers, just not at Burgerville. So I've been doing solidarity work. But from the outside, right, I think this buttons issue was probably the most exciting thing, the exciting organizing work that I've seen the union do. I think we've done a lot of really exciting stuff, but to watch folks coming together across race, taking a stand on these issues, right? It wasn't just white workers, it wasn't just black workers, it was folks coming together and taking a stand on these issues at work. I think that was the most exciting thing I've seen this union do that has made me feel so proud. And I think it's inspiring to other low-wage workers, like inspiring to workers of all sorts, that these issues are workplace issues, right? Like how we experience racism is a workplace issue.
Absolutely.
Because you can't leave that shit at the door.
Especially in fast food.
Especially in fast food, and especially in work that is racialized.
There's a really good book by Saru Jayaraman, who is the director of Rock United Restaurant Opportunity Center. And they're a worker center that they're mostly based out of New York and D.C., but they're national in scope. And she wrote a fantastic book called Forked that lays out the historical role of not just the fast food industry or the food service industry, but the service industry more broadly, that the reason that so many of those jobs actually are devalued mm-hmm. Is because they were jobs that used to be done by enslaved people.
That's right.
So
and we have to talk about this.
It must come out.
The racialization of low-wage work.
Yes.
That happened after, you know, slavery became illegal.
Yeah. Well, officially.
Officially.
Yeah.
Right. Of certain forms.
So 1865, the Emancipation Proclamation, and that was followed by what was supposed to be a successful era of Reconstruction before it was overturned by violent white mobs of terrorists, who I guess today we would call them lone wolves, but I guess we won't get into that. the reason that Reconstruction was a failure was because of a reign of white terror that actually upended it, and that's how you get the Black Codes and Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. And it is in that era of reconstituting the economy, mm-hmm. That the acceptance of low wage work becomes so pervasive. And one of the reasons that, and I think we should talk about this honestly, in talking about the labor movement and how the IWW is different in many ways today and certainly historically, is that labor unions for some time really did not take an active role mm-hmm. in fighting back against a racist norm in many parts of the country at many critical junctures. Certainly there were times that they did, but when they didn't, it's really blaring. And I think that it has not left the psyche of a lot of Americans, particularly Americans of color.
I think that's super important to bring up when we're talking about union organizing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the IWW is not squeaky clean. You know, if you look into the, you know, all the things that happened and all the time, it's not squeaky clean. It's certainly not squeaky clean today. Mm-hmm. But I think that we have many instances been on the forefront. Back in the day, we were one of the first integrated unions. We organized, you know, all workers. We believed in an international working class, and
at a time where that was controversial.
At a time where that was controversial, and we also, you know, there was some real effort. There was cross border organizing with mine workers on the U.S. Mexico border that said, and this is right at the time of the Mexican Revolution. Like this is at the time of saying, like, you know, this whole fight between, you know, douchebag bosses in the South and the bosses in the North, you know, this is all the same. Where we need to unite as mm-hmm. as workers across this border, today in the IWW, there's been lots of really interesting examples. There was a really inspiring one that has stuck with me forever of the right at the time of Ferguson. There were Wobblies organizing in a UPS warehouse distribution center outside of Twin Cities in Minnesota. And they started noticing these packages.
That's Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Minneapolis, St. Paul. They started noticing these packages with this label. It said something like Police Targets, Inc. or something.
Oh, dear.
And they noticed that was the company they were coming from. And they noticed some of them were going to Ferguson. They were going across the country, but some of them were going to Ferguson, Missouri. And so the workers, this Wobblies mm-hmm. in there, Googled them. We're like, what is this company? You know, what do they do? Mm-hmm. What are we?
I hope you're not telling on anybody right now. Does everybody know?
Oh no,
this
one public. No,
okay.
This one public. This one public. No.
I said I will snitch. Okay.
And this was back a few years ago.
Okay.
You know, we are handling these packages. We as workers are complicit in whatever this company is doing. Mm-hmm. What did they find when they Googled it? This company supplied a line of targets called the Don't Hesitate line. Mm-hmm. And it was intentionally produced targets of people who, quote, looked innocent. Mm. Holding guns. Mm. So it would be like older people, you know, mothers with kids. And then the
people
goal,
with white skin.
I don't remember exactly what the skin color, but a lot of them were, I think.
Okay.
The goal was to train police officers not to hesitate to mm-hmm. use lethal force.
Uh-huh.
And so these workers said, "This is ridiculous.
Sure,
I am not going to be complicit in this." Mm-hmm. And they organized themselves into an action that they ended up calling "Hands Up, Don't Ship." Where they intentionally mishandled those packages for a whole day.
Well, thank you, Wobblies.
You know, and that's
how you make it topple down. You
and
see,
that's what unions should be, and that's sure. what, you know, that we need to be, because these issues, you know, racism and white supremacy and settler colonialism, these are breaking the backs of workers. These systems are core pillars that hold capitalism together and core pillars that hold our lives to be
no
what
doubt.
They are. And if unions don't stand against them, and we're doomed. And workers see that. And I think that's what I was going to get back to your point about this legacy of the racism and the sort of disappointing ends of the labor movement on this issue, that workers feel that. You know, and so when they see a union unions come in, and this is our hope, and we've seen this too. When we come in and we're like, no, all these issues are our issues, yeah, too. This is not a particular sort of, oh, this is not a, what's the word they use, interest group.
Ah,
you know, okay. We don't approach it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, these are core issues of human freedom, mm-hmm, and fighting against oppression, and we're going to take them and have the hard conversations. You know, at least that's what we aspire to do.
Okay.
So
thank you. So I'm hoping that before you give the good word for people to join you, I actually want you to give a word to current Burgerville workers that might be listening, or if you're listening right now, if you know someone that works at Burgerville, tell them to tune in right now, because I want them to hear out some of the organizers themselves, because the boss may very well try to keep workers from being able to talk union stuff, mm-hmm, on the job. So if you don't have the time on the floor, or if you feel that the manager might target you, and you actually have good reason to think that they might, depending on the manager, well, here's your big chance to listen to what some of the organizers at Burgerville actually have to say to you. Take it away, y'all.
I got burned on the fryer today. Not super bad, just a little bit. And it was a really busy day. And I was rushing. You know, I was reaching my arm. I was getting one of the new adzuki patties out of the grill, and I was reaching out, and I had started getting delicate.
Patty?
Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Had to reach in. These things are really delicate, as you know. You know, they fall apart really easy. I was reaching there to get it, and one of the freezers is on the fritz, and it was there was an ice chunk in one of the fries, and it popped while I was in the fryer. And grease splashed on my arm. It's okay. I'm okay. It's not the end of the world. But to the Burgerville workers out there, that's not special. This is what happened to you on Wednesday. You know, we work. You know, we put our bodies on the line. Mm-hmm. We're pushing out thousands of dollars of burgers every single day. You know, and I see people's passion for making people happy with good food, you know?
And thank you for that.
I'm glad to do it. And we're glad to do it. And to you Burgerville workers out there, I also know that you went home to an apartment that you didn't have time to clean, that wasn't cleaned when you moved in, because your landlord doesn't actually think that you're worth having a clean apartment. And you opened your fridge that was painfully small, except for those Burgerville burgers that you brought home that are still in the fridge, and you're going to microwave them and eat them because that's what you got.
Yikes.
And that's what's going on for you right now.
Yeah.
And you deserve better.
Absolutely.
And more than just deserve better monetarily, you deserve, mm-hmm, respect. And let me say, this is going to sound controversial, but it's true.
This is the show.
We can't.
Just don't curse.
We can't demand. Yeah, thank you. We can't demand respect. Mm-hmm. We can't demand respect, because respect is not something that's given because someone is afraid or whatever. Respect is given because someone respects you, right? The only way that we're going to have the Burgerville respect us, the only way we're going to have the customers respect us, is if we have our own power, is if we have our own source of strength. And the only way the only strength we have is standing together.
Sure.
The only strength that we have is working together, is taking action on the job, because we make those burgers, we make the Burgerville money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the union's all about.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think that you deserve that respect, which I think you do, and if you think you deserve a better life for you and your family and your friends, and I think you do, then we're here for you, you know? And we're here not to save you. We're here to help you stand with the people you work with every day, with the people who work at other Burgervilles every day, with the fellow workers out there who love and support you no matter what. We're here to help you build power for yourself,
mm,
and to change the world. Because it's starting at Burgerville, and we're the first whatever in 30 years fast food union, but we're doomed if we're the last.
Okay.
So all your friends who work at burger joints and all your friends who work at car washes and all your friends that do home care,
yeah.
you gotta get them organized and you gotta get them fired up.
Yeah. You sound like Eugene Debs. You know, the...
There's a wobbly.
What was the famous... if I could lead you to the promised land, I wouldn't. Mm. Because if I could lead you in, someone else could lead you out. So... Look up Eugene. Next week, Eugene Debs. No. He's passed away.
And just to, I think, support what Luis is saying, I don't think, you know, Burrville workers know how hard it is, you know, like, to work at Burrville and to go through what they go through to make minimum wage in a city where that is nowhere near enough to pay rent. Right, Burrville workers know every day. You all experience it every day, and I think there's such an exciting opportunity to stand with your coworkers. Like, this is you and your coworkers, like, coming together and taking your power into your own hands, and to create. I think to find that change, that just, you know, quitting your job and finding another shitty job next is not gonna do, right? And I think, right. And who does that benefit, right? For workers to say, this is messed up, I'm going to just quit and go start a new job. Who does that benefit if folks just keep cycling through hard, underpaid jobs?
Yeah. The boss,
right? Yeah. And there's people who make literal money off of this.
Yeah, sure.
And there's this amazing opportunity right now, and it will always be there, to unite with your coworkers and make something actually happen that is not only going to, like, change your own life, but hopefully for the lives of Burrville workers to come.
Right? Sure.
Like, this is about changing what it means to work at Burrville for you and for folks who work there in the future.
Excellent. Thank you. It's really good. So finally, to people that are listening that have not yet supported the organizing, that have not yet been out on a picket, that are not yet boycotting Burgerville until they bargain and you come to an agreement, please convince someone who may be on the fence to go ahead and become as strong a supporter as Alyssa Pariah, host of The Struggle on KBOO 90.7 FM.
That's a tall order.
Yeah.
So convincing someone respect the boycott or just support work?
Yeah, just
work?
Generally. Mm. Get people to even join you.
Mm. I mean, I think what's, right, like, why I support the Burrville workers is I see people rising up against systems that affect all of us, right? Like, the Burrville workers in this struggle, their struggle affects me, and it affects all the workers in Portland. It affects all fast food workers everywhere.
Yes.
And whether or not the victories that they all have, the, like, struggles that they have, affect me. Because as workers, we all struggle under the same system that pits us against each other, right?
What's that system called?
Capitalism.
Oh, okay.
Look it up.
I did that.
I think, and it's, I think what's important to know is, and something so beautiful about wobbly organizing in particular,
it's revolutionary.
It is revolutionary, and that there is an international working class, that we're all there, that all of us are workers, and employers benefit off of pitting workers, you know, against each other.
No doubt.
Whether they're Black, whether they're migrants, whether they're
in another country,
yeah. Across borders. Yeah. Of different genders, whatever.
Sure.
I lost my train of thought. Yeah. So why I support the Burrville workers is that whatever happens here has real consequences. And there's so much amazing stuff that workers are already doing, right?
Yeah.
Like, the things that, everything that happened with the buttons, that's the first time I'd have ever seen anything like that.
Mm.
And it inspired my coworkers at my last job.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a call, I think, we are all witness to the call of Burrville workers, that if you have a job, you can organize, right? And that is very much the project of Burrville organizing, is that we're starting with Burrville and we're moving on to fast food organizing everywhere. We're moving on to all low-wage work everywhere and all workplaces everywhere.
Yes, please. Right?
And that's what needs to happen if we really want to, you know, take back the power and dignity that we deserve.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I interrupted you just because I wasn't sure that you were going to say workers in other countries. I felt it was very important. The working class has no country. The borders we got, those are not our borders. Those are their borders. You have everything in common with a worker in Ghana, in China, in Palestine, and nothing in common with the bosses here. So act like it, please.
Yeah. What is it? The enemy doesn't show up from a different country, shows up
in a limousine. Yes. Give the pitch, please.
I think my pitch is pretty similar. I think that, you know, we don't like your boss either. You know, your life isn't working either. It's working in some ways, and I'm happy for you for that. But it's not really working. This isn't freedom.
Say, you know, that.
And for those of you who do feel like it's freedom and have a lot of, like, reason to feel like it's freedom, I don't know if I want your solidarity.
Oh, baby.
Because that's pity then. That's you thinking that wouldn't it be nice to share my big table with you? Yeah. No, I want comrades in struggle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think the boycott's about. That's what I think standing on picket lines is about. It's about you understanding that you've got things to fight for. Mm-hmm. You've got things that you need to change. You're on the bad end of lots of sticks. And us winning is going to make you winning more possible. Us fighting is making you fighting more possible. As our horizon goes, your horizon grows too. And that's the kind of solidarity I want. I want accomplices.
Okay. You got one in me. That is the kind of solidarity that you get and that hopefully all my listeners will bring. The next time that the Burgerville workers have a picket line, I will tell you all about it, and hopefully you all will be able to come with me. Yes, the struggle will be live from the next Burgerville picket. I very much look forward to it. I have a team of people that are coming around me right now. Fendi, I know you're listening. I love you. And I love all of the people that are listening right now on The Struggle. I will see you all next week. This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. Good night.
Thanks so much. Solidarity.
Okay. Now look at the camera and say goodbye to all of your adoring fans. Look at all the hearts. That's all.
From the radio station that brought you the Fall Drive thank you spot comes an on-air acknowledgement so controversial it will blow your mind.
On behalf of the entire KABU community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KABU's holiday membership drive. Your support makes KABU possible. Thank you.
Oh, the humanity!
Our end-of-year fundraising campaign is still going on. Go to kboo.fm/give to donate right now.
Radio will never be the same again.
Support KABU, where music makes the movement.